Hello and welcome to another episode from Akadi Magazine's Connecting Communities podcast. My name is Abna Sowa, the publishing editor of Akadi Magazine, and I'm joined by...
Hello, my name is Kofi Amu. I'm editor at Akadi Magazine.
You will have heard that sultry voice because he interviewed Uncle Mike.
Uncle Mike Egan, the magnificent emperor.
So we're back with you today because we want to introduce a new segment that we have on our podcast. So some of you, if you follow us on social media, you'll remember that we've been talking about the books we've been reading on the Danish presence in what we now call Ghana. And we've got a number of books that we've read, and it's focused on that period around the 18th and 19th century when there were a number of Danish merchants, officers, clergymen that were living in Accra, and they gave accounts of what it was like to live in this, what we now call the city. At that time it was a town, and some of these books have been translated into English. The translator is called Selina Axelrod Winsness, but we'll give you a full list of all of the names of the books at the end of this little segment. But the idea behind us talking about these books that we've read is we've learned so much about, I guess, the thought processes, what people thought, their opinions of us then. We've also understood a lot about the terrain, the environment, the food that we were eating at the time. So this period is the 18th and 19th century. But some of you will know that the Danes actually came to what we now call Ghana in around the mid-17th century. And they didn't leave until 1850, when the castle, which many of us know as Christiansburg Castle, also known as Usu Castle, was sold to the British. So they had that period of around 200 years in and around Accra area. And that's what we're going to be focusing on. So we've got a new segment called Challenging Perspectives. And the idea behind that is to explore through these books and by talking to historians to find out what life was like for the ordinary person in that area that we call Accra and surrounding areas at that time. And we've just discovered some really interesting elements in all of the books that we've read, and we wanted to just share some of those with you and also have a little discussion, just a little introduction before we step into those bigger questions with the historians that we'll be planning on speaking to. So I wanted to just start. I've done a lot of talking.
Yeah, so if I might jump in for a moment. I mean, yes, I've read the same books, quite a few of them, and they've been absolutely fascinating. And I think I find the more I read, the more questions I have, the more I read, the more sometimes infuriated I become. But obviously all so fascinating, and my perspective has changed to some extent since reading these books. For example, the two books that I focus on mostly at the moment are written by Selina, and the two views from Christiansburg Castle. And it really narrates the story of two chaplains who were there almost 100 years apart. One is Rusk, who was the first, and Monrad the second, and how they viewed us. And they kind of make notes of so many things about Ghana and gave accounts of their experiences. A reasonable insight, but only of that immediate area on the coast. They didn't venture too far inland. But yes, the account of Accra I found fascinating. And I think I'll let you come in and work.
What I wanted to say was, so we both read Rask. I haven't read Monrad, but you've read Monrad's book. So yeah. Rask came to what we now call, well, I'll say Accra, from 1708 to 1713. So he lived in Christiansburg Castle. I found reading his book difficult, but also really, really interesting. And I say difficult because this guy is, I mean, the language is so racist, you know, so it's hard to read it. So at times I had to put it down. I don't know how you felt.
Absolutely the same. I wanted to tear his head off if he was in front of me.
Yeah. I mean, he's so disparaging about our people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very dismissive.
Yeah.
Belittling. In fairness, sorry to cut you, but sometimes, even though when he wanted to say, he would say something good, like they were good swimmers, but then he would add words that, but they swam like, not dogs, or because they did the doggy stroke or something. So he would then disparage it, although they'd saved him probably and saved other Westerners, you know, from being drowned. He would commend them, and every time that he commended them, he would then say something negative about them just to put them down.
Yeah, like in the next sentence, he had to cut it down. Yeah. So it was really difficult to read, and I think, we would encourage you to read the books that we're talking about. So let me just, for this, just because we've discussed Rask, I'm just going to just mention the name. The two views from Christiansberg Castle. So Johannes Rask, who was there between 1708 and 1713. And then you have, so that's volume one. So it's a brief and truthful description of a journey to and from Guinea. And this was translated from Danish into English by Selina Axelrod Winsness. And then the second book is almost 100 years later,
and also, that's also called Two Views from Christiansborg Castle, and again this is H.C. Monrad, who was in the Guinea coast between 1805 and 1809, and obviously translated by Selina Axelrod Winsness. And I found Rask, who was there in the 1700s, and Monrad, who came in 100 years later, their views were so completely different. And to the extent that you find that Monrad, who came later, was actually very, very aware of what Rask had written and disagreed with the way he spoke about the people of the Guinea, which is how that area was referred to at the time. So it's things like that. And he was kinder, but again, as I always say, I'm not fooled by his kindness. There is a level of honesty about what he has written. These are their accounts of their day-to-day
experiences
during their stay in that area.
So as much as we are sharing their views, we have to also remember these are through the lens of Europeans, and they had their particular views on us. So what I found, I say us, you know, we weren't there, but like our ancestors. But I say that because even though Monrad would be seen as a progressive,
yes,
he still had, you know, quite abhorrent views, I would say, if you want to explain, because you read that
one. Yeah, I mean, Monrad's view, he was against slavery, didn't like the trade, and he felt that the people who were the enslaved people were treated very badly and it was abhorrent and so on. Yet he was keen to have, and he was against transatlantic slavery, the movement of people from, say, the Guinea. I'll use the Guinea or Accra in this situation, to the Caribbean, but didn't mind to a large extent having them work on plantations, which is again another form of slavery, but locally. You know, so there is, yes, he was a bit more benevolent and so on in terms of the way he spoke, and spoke rather flowery of our people. I mean, he even said, look, our cooking, it was a local people who helped them survive their times there, because often these Europeans, within a year or two, they would die.
Yeah.
You know, and it was only by the nursing and cooking and washing and looking after them that some of them survive as long as they did. And in fact, both Monrad and Rask were sick and ill so often, and so many times they were close to death. Especially Rask, he couldn't wait to get out by the time he got out.
Yeah.
And he actually wrote that he was so glad he made it back, you know, to his country. So yeah, I mean, on the one hand, he's talking benevolently. On the other hand, these plans for a resolution to the situation is to have them stay there and work and grow food and so on, which is cash crop, and to export to Europe. And
I think you talk about Isert, who is mentioned,
yes,
and his plans.
Yeah, Isert was a businessman, and he kind of had the same idea. And I think actually Monrad got the idea from Isert, and I think there's another gentleman called Roma. They felt that, look, this is not the way to do it. Let's not transport them. And actually they thought, never mind the abhorrentness of the trade, I think they felt it was even more economical.
Mm.
It's more, and so they were thinking more of the economics than the actual concern for the people who were being transported thousands of miles away.
And what's interesting is there was a film that I actually went to see in 2015, a Danish film called The Gold Coast, mm-hmm. which depicts a man called Wolf, Joseph Wolf. We've also read his autobiography and also his papers. And there's two things. First of all, these books were considered Bibles that they would give to people who were travelling to the Guinea. These are the books that they would have read. So the lens with which they would have seen us would have been through these books. That's the first thing. But the second thing is, the wolf that is depicted in the film is actually an amalgamation of a three actual officers that went to what we now call Ghana. And what's interesting in the film, if you watch it, the wolf in the film is going to develop a plantation. So some of the things that we mm-hmm. read about in here is what was used to create this fictitious, to a degree, based on real events film called The Gold Coast. Thank God Iset died. Yes. The real Iset died, so his plan to create plantations did not materialise.
In fact, it started.
Oh, he started it, but it didn't
He died before the whole thing could pan out. So yeah. That was the end of that, thankfully. So basically, that time, when you read these books, you get this fascination. On the one hand, Europeans came, had this level of superiority, but in the beginning, they were respectful. To be honest, it seemed that they were respectful, so they were afraid of sort of contravening our traditions, and because they wanted to get a foothold, they wanted to get in. So they had to be respectful of our traditions and so on. They believed in a fetish and things like that, or operated according to what we did with fetishes and so on. They were afraid to kill a snake, which would have been a natural instinct, because we live with snakes as though they were pets. And if you'd killed a snake and you got caught, you were as good as dead as a white man.
Yeah.
So they were even afraid of things like that. So they really did kind of respect our traditions in that regard until they got to the point where they felt they had a foothold and they didn't care.
And I feel like I need to go into two directions. So first of all, I'll just talk about, there was an entry in Rask where he talks about the snakes that were in somebody's house. These snakes are in the, I'm going to say the rafters.
Yes.
They're like everywhere and they're just not bothered. Like, if I think about a snake being anywhere close to me, I am running. But I just thought it was lovely to just read this about how we were so comfortable with animals that we wouldn't be comfortable with now.
Absolutely. Even today, Ghana, you see a snake. In my childhood, I saw a snake and the instinct was to kill it.
Yeah.
And today, there's people see a snake, they'll kill it. But then, in those days, they didn't trouble the snake, and the snake was respected.
And that I find interesting, because throughout this book, throughout these books, you'll find things that I would say are not familiar to me as a Ghanaian, or the Ghana that I know, or the culture that I've been raised knowing. So, for example, there's another thing that you told me about, this relationship with death.
Yes, it's interesting. I believe it's in Monrad's, and it's even to the extent that people felt if their lives were not going well, things were not going well for them, they will commit suicide with the knowledge that it can't be worse in the next life, in the next where they're going, and they'll be better off there. When you read it, it's quite chilling.
So seemingly in easily, because if you're considering that there's an afterlife and you believe in an afterlife, which I think, when I think about the Egyptians,
mm-hmm.
that's just so embedded into their traditions.
Absolutely.
So yeah. We would see that as being a negative, you know, to commit suicide is terrible, and if you're caught committing suicide, you'll go to prison. But this idea that it was almost normal.
Yes, it could be normal. Things were not going well. Okay, I've had enough of this life. I'll see you at the other side. And then they would kill themselves.
And what I find interesting about that is, during burials, people were buried with, you know, like things that they would need in another life.
Yes. And sorry to cut you. In fact, even if the individual was high standing in society, they would even give servants who would die with them to then serve them in the afterlife.
Which to me sounds like when I think of the Egyptians and the pharaohs, that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
So we know that I've heard it many a time, especially in my culture, if we think of our culture, Akan cultures, mm-hmm. where if the king dies, people need to run for cover.
Yes. Yes.
Because they could be one of those that yes. will be yes. sacrificed.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I've heard of, and we're talking about Akan now, we're not even talking about what's happening in, you know, the
on
southern
the coast, yes.
Yeah. But even like if you were a king and you died, I've heard of instances where the wife is also sacrificed.
Would go with you, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, this sort of afterlife thing, which for me has this connection to another part of Africa, which is a lot further along. Mm-hmm. I don't see that reflected now. There was another thing, though, about some of the chiefs, some of the kings being buried seated, some being buried
standing.
Yeah. And is that also ordinary people being buried standing?
That didn't occur to me. Whenever there was burial and standing or seated, it seemed to be those who were the noble people or those who were like the kabusiers. And the kabusiers were the business people who controlled certain sectors of the various areas of Gao, Su, and they were the ones who had were wealthy, and therefore when they were buried, their burials were more spectacular than an ordinary person.
But now we don't bury our dead standing. I mean, I know that some, isn't it common in Jewish culture to bury the dead standing?
Well, this is what you find with Wolf Joseph Wolf, who was it the other book we read, we both read, there's a Danish Jew in West Africa. And it's by
well, Selina as well. She was prolific.
Yes, yes. And it's quite interesting in his life. He was there between
1835, I believe.
36 to 42. And he married
Sarah Marm,
who is termed as an Euro-African. In other words, she was mixed race, really.
Yeah, you know? So she had Danish ancestry and mm-hmm. Gar ancestry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they had three children together. And he did not refer to her as his wife. And there was a tradition during that time. I'm not sure when it began.
Well, the casia comes from the Portuguese word to marry. Casia. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes.
And it was a name that was a word that was adopted by subsequent Europeans that came. And what I find interesting, and I'm just going to refer to Per Neil Ipson's book, which is called Daughters of the Trade, Atlantic Slavers and the Interracial Marriage on the Gold Coast. Mm-hmm. So this book just blew my mind. It's one of my favourites out of all that we've read. And on page 7, she actually refers to the importance of marrying in to communities wherever, you know, the Europeans landed in order to ensure that you're trading and have the ability to trade. So she refers to Europeans were trading fur in North America, textiles in India, gold and enslaved Africans in Africa. And they gained access to local trading networks by marrying into local families. Such trading marriages became important social and political networks in the history of early modern European trade and colonial expansion. So although kazia means marry, I feel like it's not the same as two Danes marrying.
Yes.
And it's like a business arrangement. One thing that I find interesting about these books that I've read and the information that I've read from them is it's not clear cut, because although we've said what we've said about Wolf and Sarah Malm, it's interesting when you read his letters, and we're going back to, I understand we're going back to, you know, the mid
early 19th century.
Yeah, so that period, so you're not going to be exuberant about how you feel about somebody because it's a different time and maybe that's not what people did. So when you read his letters, he doesn't actually refer to Sarah Malm. The letters that we have, we're not saying that's the complete letters, there might be more.
I'm sure there's more.
Yeah, but he doesn't refer to her as his wife. He talks about a housekeeper that's teaching him gain.
Yeah.
He talks about, I need a ball and I need certain things for children of a certain age, a hat. And it's like, well, who are these people? Yes. Are these your children? Why don't you say they're your children? You know, it's a bit different to now, but I guess we're thinking of it in now terms.
Yes, we need to actually be cautious in terms of how we interpret all of this. Because yeah. We'll have to conjecture quite a bit about these. But
yeah,
very, very, very interesting reads.
Yeah, and also, let's just to add some, I don't know, something to the mix. A lot of these women that would have married these Danish men, even though they would have been part Danish, there was not one example that I could find in the books where the women were comfortable with maybe going back to Denmark with the husbands because of this understanding that if you left the coast, those sort of maybe rights or privileges left you, you may become enslaved yourself.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think part of it, even during that time when Wolf's time, when the slave trade had been abolished and primarily the transatlantic slave trade had been abolished, life in that area was still rather precarious and you could be picked up and put on a ship and before you know it, you've disappeared, your family won't find you.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think this proximity to whiteness was very important. So you'll see that in the way that people dressed. If you had a drop of European blood in you, the dressing started to evolve. You know, you'd be likely to be educated in the castle.
Yes, yes.
If you were male, you'd become a merchant. So you would basically be trading people who looked like your ancestors on one side of your family. And that would be acceptable or the norm.
Yeah, and they became another social strata, didn't they? They were in between the Europeans and the Africans, and they lorded it over both, really, because then they held a lot of power. Ironically, they've all disappeared now, but yeah.
Only in visually, but the names,
yeah, of course.
The names, yes, still the
legacy,
remain.
Yeah, legacies, yeah. And many names that we can mention, which we won't.
Engman.
Okay,
that's,
we will.
Okay.
We will. I mean, so many names that are around. And they're not just Danish. There are lots of European names.
Yeah,
still,
the Dutch, literal.
Gosh, there's this.
The Bruise.
The Bruise, and so on. There's so many vestiges of these relationships, which, and now, and some of them are still fairly well off, and yeah.
So are there any particular, you know, because we can talk about this forever basically,
forever.
But is there something notable out of everything you've read that sticks in your mind that you want to just share, something that you really...
It's a finish off, and we're talking about the Euro-Africans, they were primarily women as well. They were the ones who held the power, although they were men because they had children as well.
Well, what I wanted to say in terms of my interest area, it's looking at the food that we ate then. It's looking at the language. So there's a part that fascinated me where it was Rask who was actually writing out some words that he'd picked up in Accra. And obviously to him, they're all one language, but, you know, I could read them and understand that that's actually an Akan word. It wasn't a Gar word. So even at his period, when he was there between 1708 and 1713, there's a mixing of the different languages
mm-hmm.
amongst these different ethnic groups. It's interesting to learn about the different terrains, like this idea that Accra was a town, the idea that the Akwamus were really quite powerful. Mm-hmm. People go to the Akyapim Hills, as you mentioned before. The food, this hatred, it seems, of the by the Europeans of our palm oil.
Yes, we need to confirm. I mean, as we discussed, or I've suggested, there are two types of palm oil. Because on the one hand, they talk about the lack of butter, so they use palm oil, and yet at some points they talk about palm oil being smelly, and I think that's a different type of palm oil. But yeah,
so that's the palm oil that you get from the
kernel,
which is white,
and then there's a palm oil which you get from the outside, and that's the red one, and that's the one I think would have been used as butter and whatever else. But my person, I mean, you're absolutely correct. From what we read, both Rusk and Monrad, they talk about the abundance of food, fruits, and they list them. And you know, Rusk doesn't actually. That's the best thing about what he did in his book, where he tells you about all the different animals and vegetables. But when he talks about it, and he talks about how bountiful all of this was, you think,
like manna from
fish
heaven,
and in different types of fish, and so on, and how good fishermen they were, and how they could catch it. And it's fascinating what the account these two men wrote, although 100 years apart. I wonder what changed, or something did change. Certainly, Monrad does say, he criticizes Rusk for what he wrote 100 years ago and says he disagrees with him. He says he was too harsh, or rather harsh and not sincere.
So what we invite you to do, we're actually going to give you a list of the books that we're talking about, just so that you can access them yourself. But just going back to what we mentioned at the beginning, this segment is called Challenging Perspectives. And the idea is for us to have a look at what it was like to live through these books and also through historians. So the first that you'll hear from is a man who's the assistant professor in art history called Hermann von Hesse, who actually has a distant links back to Wolf. He has Danish ancestry, and he's a Ghanaian, he's a Ga. He is an assistant professor at Urbana-Champaign in the USA, and this is kind of like his area, so he talks.
Fascinating discussion. In fact, I won't even call it discussion, because you allowed him to give out so much information.
Yeah,
I've listened to it so many times, and you know, I pick up bits and pieces each time I listen to this conversation you had with Herman.
And I think one bit that I find interesting is he will speak about the definition of chattel slavery, and again, that's what we're trying to do, is to understand those definitions, because we're very well versed on what it means to be enslaved from a European perspective. But in talking about that, we also draw in the book by Professor Akosua Purbi.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, who also talks about it as well. So I guess what we're saying is these books together really give you a well-rounded view, and maybe we'll challenge some of those perspectives that you have on what it might have been like to live at that point. Because that's the interesting thing. What would it have been like for an ordinary person to have these Europeans that came, you know, they've been here for many, many hundreds of years by that point, if we're talking about the early 1700s.
They were there in the 1400s, weren't they?
So it's not new, but this is like another wave of them coming. But also this trade in people that is happening around you as well. And then also we had our internal system of servitude, you know, and that's what Herman will mention and discuss.
And of course, your Pepe's book is fascinating on that. In fact, I haven't read Monrad Rusk and was so agitated. I wanted to balance it, thinking I could balance it with Akosua Purbi, and she kind of confirms that there are so many things. And I think, I read every two pages and I had to put the book down because I was so annoyed. You know,
So honestly, this will test your nerves, these books. But let me just quickly list them. And we'll put this in the description so you'll have, you know, it written out as well. So we have talked about the two books. It's The Two Views from Christiansburg Castle, Volume 1, A Brief and Truthful Description of a Journey to and from Guinea. So this is by Johannes Rusk, and he was in Accra between 1708 and 1713. Then also H.C. Monrad, 1805 to 1809, and that's volume 2, so it's got the same title. These are both written by Selena Axelrod Winsness. She has also written the book A Danish Jew in West Africa, Wolf, Joseph Wolf, Biography and Letters, 1836 to 1842. And we also have another book by a Dane, a lot more modern in terms of when she wrote it, but this is Daughters of the Trade, Atlantic Slavers and Interracial Marriage on the Gold Coast, Pernille Ibsen. So those are the Danish books. The other two that I want to just mention, because we just mentioned it in passing. So Professor Akosua-Pirbi's book is A History of Indigenous Slavery in Ghana from the 15th century to the 19th century. So this is a really valuable book to read. And we've got another book which has an excerpt from a paper by Akosua-Pirbi. But this is called Slavery and Its Legacy in Ghana and the Diaspora. It's edited by Rebecca Shumway and Trevor R. Getz, and it's by Bloomsbury. So we'll put all the publisher details and where you can get them from. And hopefully you will come back and tell us what you think. You know, this is a discussion. We're having a discussion about all of these different things. And we will hope to invite more historians, starting off with Herman, who will explain the things that we can't, because we're just talking and asking questions and learning. So is there anything you want to say?
Yeah, what I would say to finish off is, I mean, no matter what your perspective is, no matter what you think now, reading these books would definitely
inform, inspire, illuminate. Okay, thank you so much for listening, and we hope you join us again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Want more? Listen now to a preview from my interview with Herman von Hesse. You can find the full discussion on our next episode. Thank you.
So people say that chattel slavery was alien to us, but insofar as you can exchange human beings with money, so far as, you know, human beings were considered to be wealth, far more valuable than land, with that, you cannot totally dismiss the idea that there's some element of chattel slavery that had got nothing to do with Europeans, right? Because people were buying and selling human beings, right? They may not have absolute control over these people like they sought to enforce on American plantations. By American, I mean America's.
Yeah.
But once you are buying and selling human beings, once you could inherit human beings, there is an element of chattel slavery there.
Hello and welcome to a new series in our Connecting Communities podcast called Challenging Perspectives, Accra, Her People and the Danes. My name is Abna Serwa, editor of Akadi magazine, and you were just listening to Herman von Hesse, Assistant Professor of African Art History at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign in the USA. Our chat with Herman is the first in a series on the Danish presence in 17th, 18th and 19th century Accra that we hope to share with you. In the first interview of this series, Herman gives us a brief overview of life in Accra prior to European settlement. He outlines how the Danes established themselves in and around Accra and draws distinctions and similarities between the European trade in people and the indigenous practice in what we now call Ghana. Our aim with this and subsequent interviews with historians and academic experts is to dig deeper into our understanding of what life was like in Accra, primarily, for the average woman, man and child, and explore what impact the presence of Europeans over the centuries has had on the exchange of ideas, how it shaped our cultures, languages, traditions, trade and more. We call this series Challenging Perspectives because we hope that these discussions will encourage us all to interrogate and challenge our perspectives, increase our knowledge and inspire us to keep asking those important questions. We hope you enjoy.